Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and her producers, Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. As you've come to expect, between now and November of 2020, you are going to hear the words every single show of Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearing in 2019. They were powerful words. The most powerful thing he said was, "Don't worry, Papa, it will be all right." And of course, what we know is it was not all right for him. It was not all right for his brother, and probably it's not all right for the country as well. So now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So, as many of you know, I'm kind of a nerd. I read things like Stat News. I go to theconversation.com. I've been a reader of the Christian Science Monitor since I was probably 11. So I'm always reading all kinds of interesting things. And I went to Stat News and I saw an article by Hank Greeley. And it was entitled, "COVID-19 Immunity Certificates, Practical and Ethical Conundrums." So let me tell you a little bit about Hank. He is, according to this article, a professor of law and a professor by courtesy of genetics at Stanford University, where he directs the Stanford Center for Law and Biosciences and chairs the steering committee for the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Professor Greeley, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This was an amazing article. And as much as the article was remarkable, the comments were even in some ways more textured because they took me in 1,000 more directions. And I think this conversation is not about immunity certificates, but I feel like it's a hydra with many heads. And you were quoted in the Washington Post, and I just want to start with that quote, and then we will get into your article. So in yesterday's Washington Post, they were talking about the possibility of these issuing these immunity certificates. The following questions were asked. Who would issue the certificates of immunity? How would people get them? What exactly would these allow people to do? And then they quote you, Hank. It looks like the train is getting ready to leave the station, and nobody has checked to see what the track ahead is like, said Henry Greeley, director of the Stanford Center for Law and Biosciences. So I want to look ahead on that track, and I want to ask you to sort of talk to us a little bit about why this idea of certificate of immunity is now beginning to percolate around the country and, frankly, around the world.
Right, so I first heard about it in Germany. Mm-hmm. The Germans announced they were going to do a 100,000-person test for antibodies among their population to see how many people had been infected. The researchers said, we will give immunity certificates to the ones who turn out to have tested positive, to have had the disease in the past. The Italians picked up the idea and started talking about it in their government. The Brits started talking about it. And I just knew it was going to hit here because people are really, understandably, interested in a quick fix. They want something that can move us back to a normal life. I want it too. I just think that they're almost all quick fixes aren't going to be all that quick and aren't likely in many cases to be fixes. And this is probably one of them. I think there is the potential that it could be useful in some circumstances. There's also the potential that it could go terribly wrong.
So one of the comments at the article at Stat News was talked about the immunity haves and the immunity have-nots. And I had been thinking about that as well. One of the dilemmas I have with this is, initially, when I first heard about COVID-19, I kept thinking, oh, I should get the disease. Because assuming I don't die, then I can help all those people. I can be helping the firefighters. I can help at the hospitals. I'm thinking of myself as Florence Nightingale. You know, that was my initial reaction. And then, of course, I was told, don't get it. We need to flatten the curve. You need to shelter in place. We need to protect people from getting it because we're overwhelming the system and the system can't handle it. And the best thing you can do is to basically try not to get the disease. So I thought, okay, that's the patriotic thing to do. That's the right thing to do. I want to protect those frontline workers. And then the concept of the immunity certificates came up. And I went, wait a minute, Hank. So I'm doing the right thing because it is the right thing. But then I don't have access to the disease. And if I don't have access to the disease, then I can't possibly have immunity. And if I can't have immunity, then maybe I can't go back to work. So let's talk about this, because this is where it gets really crazy.
So let's start with the very first and I think most important uncertainty. Does having the disease, does having antibodies to the disease make you immune in the future?
Exactly.
And the answer to that is, quite honestly, we don't know. Ask again in a year or two when we've had people who've had the disease a year or two before and we were able to see whether they can get sick or not. There are other coronaviruses out there. This is one of eight forms of a coronavirus that infects humans. Some of them provide immunity for a couple of years, we think. Some of them we know only provide immunity for a year or less. There are a couple of very common cold viruses that are coronaviruses, and their immunity doesn't last very long. We know of one monkey that was infected and then developed antibodies and could not be reinfected. So we got one monkey on the plus side. On the other hand, there are 91 people as of last week in South Korea who the Korean authorities say, we thought they were healthy, they had gotten sick, we thought they were cured, they had a negative test, and then they got sick again. Mm. Oh, now, wow. We don't know what that means. Yeah. Maybe the negative test was wrong, because there are a lot of flaws with the test to see whether you actually have the virus at this minute or not. About 30% of the time, you get a false negative. About 30% of the people who actually are infected show up as non-infected. Maybe that's what happened in Korea. Mm-hmm. Maybe the disease was always there and just kind of hiding, or maybe they got reinfected. We don't know. And if we started confidently saying, okay, you've been sick, you can't get anybody else sick, you can't get sick again yourself, and that turns out to be wrong, that could be a really serious error. Not just for the person who goes out and gets himself sick. I mean, yes, it's nice that you didn't decide to play Florence Nightingale and get yourself sick. Not just for you, though. You getting sick not only makes you sick and imposes your costs on the healthcare system, but it also increases the chances that other people will get sick because of you, that you will infect other people.
Okay, so that's just one of the Hydra heads. The head that says, we don't know whether the immunity works. We don't know how long. We don't know whether you get sick again.
Yep.
The assumption that you were beginning to sort of hear about in Germany and Italy and other places was that there is some immunity. The immunity may last. It may last only a couple of months. It may last a year. We have no idea. But maybe there is. Okay.
Yep.
So now let's go down that track. Okay. That there is some kind of immunity. We don't know what the time frame is, but maybe you have to be recertified every 3 months. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do that. But then I laugh because the group of people that will not have immunities initially are going to be the most affluent and the most successful. Because if you look at I love this. This is the part that I kind of love. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's the bottom is going to surge forward. Because the people who've been forced to be frontline workers, the people who are in the fields picking the crops, or in the prison, or in the grocery stores, or at the hospitals, the frontline workers, they're the ones who can't make a decision about sheltering in place because they're frontline workers.
Right.
They're the ones that have the greatest opportunity of getting the disease. And if they survive it, which we hope like 95, 98% of them do, they will have immunity. There's an irony here that the privilege, a la moi, who can stay in her third floor attic and never contract the disease, now is privileged not to get it, but now has a liability of not having gotten it.
Unless or until we get a vaccine that works.
Exactly.
And that is the long-term best hope. I would note one exception, though. You're right about the irony of the privileged and underprivileged. There is a big exception. The group of privileged who are on the front lines, the doctors, nurses, you know, the healthcare workers who are at risk run the gamut from very poorly paid janitorial custodial staff to very well-paid physician specialists. Those are the people who are most on the front line, in part because it looks like, again, millions of things we don't know about. This is a new virus. There are millions of things we don't know about it, but it looks like the more virus you get exposed to, the more likely you are to get sick. So if I'm walking down the road and somebody walks past me and coughs, I get unhappy, I'm unlikely to get sick. If I'm in a hospital room with a patient who is violently coughing, gagging, et cetera, and my protective equipment is insufficient, because in one of the many unforgivable things about this, our response to this pandemic, we're sending frontline workers out there with insufficient equipment, my risks are much higher. So yeah, for the most part, the privileged have this ironic immunity from getting sick, which gives them immunity to, which fails to give them immunity from getting sick in the future, but not perfectly. But you're right. I think they're probably, the consensus seems to be there's likely to be immunity for some time, but we need to watch that carefully and monitor it. Yeah. But even then, so what do you do? Who gives out these certificates? Is it the federal government? Is it the state government? Is it Joe COVID certificate company? If I put myself up in business and say, I'm a COVID certificate company, and I give you nice little cards laminated with your photo, does a restaurant accept that? Does a sporting event accept that? If it's state and you're in New Hampshire and you cross the line into Vermont, does it count?
I know.
You know, just a huge number of very practical questions like that, and fraud.
Well, that's where I was going to go. So I'm thinking, okay, I have a driver's license. I may have a green card. I have a social security card. I have a library card. I have a passport. Now I've got a COVID card, okay? I've got a COVID immunity card. So what I'm thinking about is the fraud piece. You know, when I look at a lot of undocumented immigrants who right now represent most of the people that are, you know, cleaning the casinos, cleaning the hotels, picking the vegetables, working in the meatpacking plants, one of the things we know about is that they contribute billions of dollars a year because they have illegal social security numbers. What scares me is that there is going to be this huge underground group that are going to want to produce these immunity cards, because the immunity cards are a very interesting passport, but they're a passport for income, okay? And that is also problematic. And we've seen that happen, where you see the sort of fake social security cards and everything else. And yet at the same time, you mentioned, who is going to issue them? And then I come from a state, the state of New Hampshire. This is the place where we have something called the Free State Project. Every libertarian in America wants to live here. And a libertarian who's told that they have to have an immunity card, I mean, it's tough enough for them to actually live anywhere that's called government, let alone having an immunity card. So as you're talking about this train going down the track, have people in Germany and Italy, as they're looking at this immunity certificate, begun to try to figure out where the controls are and who is the issuer?
Not as far as I can tell. In fact, the German one's interesting. It sounded like it was well along, but it turns out it's a research project that hadn't even been, and as far as I know, hasn't even been funded yet.
Wow.
But that's what got all the publicity. The closest I think we've seen is in China, where people were required to have sort of their status, their infected status, not antibody status, because there are a few tests around. There's been a little bit of survey work done in various places, but that's just not ready yet. Another problem for the immunity certificate. But in China, you'd have to have on your cell phone something with your immunity status, and you'd have to show it. And I'm guessing, although I don't know for sure, that the Chinese were pretty careful about who could issue that on your cell phone.
My daughter lives in Shanghai. This is like my second round of COVID-19 because I lived with her in the late winter, the winter. So as she was like sort of going through the hysteria of their COVID-19, and then of course now we're in our sort of COVID-19 mode. One of the things, again, this is an incredibly authoritarian society. I mean, you get your temperature taken when you leave your apartment. You get your temperature taken when you come back to your apartment. You get your temperature taken when you go to the grocery store. You get your temperature taken when you go on the subway. On the subway, every single person. They're also following everyone. So not only do you have to show where you were yesterday, they know where you were yesterday. So they're doing this sort of community policing almost. And so the level of oversight is something that would never, ever happen here. And yet at the same time, they don't have a certificate. They almost have a community certificate because they know everything about everyone.
So in the U.S., we'd never put up with that. It might not even be constitutional, depending on how it comes into play. And I'm confident there would be people selling fake certificates. And not only selling them, but, you know, let's say we get to the state, to the position where in order to go into a restaurant or a bar, you've got to show a certificate. You got an interest in being able to go to the bar. The bar owner has an interest in being able to sell as much liquor as possible. I'm reminded when I was a freshman in college, drinking age was 21. Two people in my dorm started selling fake IDs.
Oh my God.
So you'd put this big thing of paper that said it was an Iowa driver's license in front of you, and there was a cutout, and you'd put your head in. They'd take a photo, and they'd laminate it. And one guy who did this told me later that he'd gone to one of the local bars, and the guy looked at it, and he said, you know, you guys misspelled the word license. And then he sold them beer anyway.
Anyway, exactly.
So when the incentives are in favor of both committing fraud and accepting fraud, it's hard to enforce. Okay. But, you know, I think the really deep, interesting issues here are, let's assume that the immunity works pretty well. Let's assume that we can figure out a reasonably honest and accurate way of doing the certificates. They'll never be perfect. What do we think about a world where you can't go to a restaurant unless you can show a certificate or, you know, go through a fingerprint, a thumbprint, or a retinal scan, or you show some other ID and they then put it into a computer and the computer up in the cloud somewhere says, yes, she's immune, she can come in. There are privacy implications there, but they're also just, I am not a New Hampshire style libertarian, but I'm libertarian enough to say, I shouldn't have to do that to go to a restaurant or to go to a sporting event, or to get on an airplane. But of course, we put up with a lot of stuff to get on an airplane already.
I think
it goes against lots of aspects of our society, and yet it will be very attractive for people who want to come back fast. Exactly. I do think there are going to be some young idiots who will hold COVID parties so that they can get sick.
Right.
Ignoring the fact that, you know, more than half of the people hospitalized for COVID are not elderly, and you can get very sick. And even if you survive, you don't want to be hospitalized with this disease.
No.
But also ignoring all the other people they might infect while they get infected. There are issues here. And yet, it seems to me there may, if we could come up with a good system for doing it, which would require some government oversight and regulation, and dirty words in many parts of the country now, you know, maybe it could be useful for healthcare workers or for people who really have necessarily face-to-face jobs, nursing home workers.
I know.
You know, we need those people desperately, but it would be really nice if we could put them out there.
So let me
some assurance they're not going to get sick.
So Hank, as I'm listening to you, first of all, I want you on CNN and I want you to hold the town hall. And I want all these questions to be asked, and I want everyone to hear it out loud together. I want to hear the questions. I want to hear the fears. I want to hear the potential mistakes. I want to hear what kind of oversight we would need. But the other thing I think about is that you're absolutely right. Maybe for hospital workers or nursing home workers or whatever, but it's not a permanent condition in the sense that this is an evolving story. We don't have medication yet to treat it. We don't have the vaccination yet. It may morph into a different kind of SARS anyway, and we don't know what's going to happen. So in a way, nothing that we come up with is permanent. Everything that we come up with may be a small step with some mistakes, but it may be a way for us to begin to adjust some of the problems that we have. You can't shut an economy down. I get that. And I want people to be safe. I get that. I'm afraid of the haves and the have-nots. I get that. But I don't know whether this is such a terrible idea, if it's good oversight and regulation, and if we realize that it's not permanent. It's a way to get us to the other side.
So we hope it's not permanent. It's almost, you know, we don't know.
I know.
I don't see any good reason why there shouldn't be a vaccine, but I've been doing law and biology for 30 years now, and biology is even less predictable than law. It's bizarre. Every rule has an exception, and every exception has a proviso. Yes. So we don't know that for sure. You're right. What I would like to see, but what our society is really bad at, is nuanced measures that have constant monitoring and are able to be changed easily. And in our society, once something gets put in place, it's really hard to change it. Especially once economic interests and social mores grow up that accept it. It's really hard to make those changes. I worry that we'll head off down the track. And, you know, if you're going slow enough and you've got good enough brakes, you see something up ahead, you can stop. If you go about it carefully, I worry that the train's going to go and nobody's going to be paying attention. We'll go off a cliff.
This is when I wish I lived in one of those Nordic countries where they are so process oriented and they're methodical and they go and they look and then they look back and then they look forward. And here we want instant gratification. We want to switch. We want to fix it. That's exactly what Donald Trump is sort of talking about right now, about having us go back to work without looking at the consequences of what that means. But I want to just read one thing from one of the comments in that article. This writer writes, "The idea of immunity certificates is neither a magic bullet, nor is it the only means to get back to normal life." And this person says, "I have a background in law, criminology, and sociology, and I can tell you that creating a stratification based on antibody haves versus antibody have-nots is going to be fraught with problems." Exactly what you just said. "I agree with Professor Greeley above in his views in that we need to be careful and think out the idea of immunity certificates with special benefits for a few and consider a number of policies that include everyone. Antibody haves and antibody have-nots." And she said, as you look at who has access to this certificate, the first person you need to consider is the one that doesn't in some ways. And I thought that was just absolutely brilliant. I hope I hear you on CNN. I hope I have you back. I want to talk about this because we are a society that wants it done tomorrow. The idea of being slow and methodical, it's not been in our gene pool. Maybe we need to figure out how to get it there. Thank you so much for joining me. I truly value your words.
Great conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Henry Greeley, a professor of law and professor by courtesy of genetics at Stanford University, where he directs the Stanford Center for Law and Biosciences and chairs the steering committee for the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. An important conversation. This is just the beginning of it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, everyone, stick around for Current Cast, which is next on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, who are my great producers.
Try not to get carried away on this Current Cast. When you think rip current, you might think the Atlantic Ocean, but rip currents are quite common in the Great Lakes as well. National Weather Service meteorologist John Hitchcock says there are a couple conditions necessary to create a rip current.
One, you need a fairly windy day that generates significant wave action. Then the second part you need is a sandy shoreline.
When the wind piles waves up on the beach, the pressure carves a trench in the sand that allows water to rush back into the lake. This happens so quickly that it carries everything out with it, including the unlucky swimmer. But don't panic. Hitchcock says you can escape from a rip current by swimming parallel to the beach. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
fingers counting, we have each 9 planets around the sun repeat. 8 ball will last if you triumphant be. 7 oceans pummel the shores of the sea. It's a typical situation in these typical times. Too many choices, yeah. It's a typical situation in these typical times. Too many choices. Everybody's happy, everybody's free. Keep the big door open, everyone will come around. Why are you different? Why are you that way? If you don't get in line, we'll lock you away. Down to nothing. 6 senses feeling fire around a sense of sound. 4 seasons turn on and turn on. I can see 3 corners from this corner. 2's a perfect number, but 1 round. Everybody's happy, everybody's free. We'll keep the big door open, everyone will come around. Why are you different? Why are you that way? If you don't get in line, we'll lock you away. Oh, everybody's happy, everybody's free. We'll keep the big door open, everyone will come around. Why are you different? Why are you that way? Don't get in line, we'll lock you away. It all comes down to nothing. It's a typical situation in these typical times. Too many choices, yeah. It's a typical situation in these typical times. Too many choices. We can do anything about it. Too many choices. It's a typical situation in these typical times. Too many choices. Everybody's happy, everybody's free. Situation in these typical times, too many choices. We can't do anything alone. Too many choices. It's a typical situation that needs to be come to an end. Too many choices.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. So we've had him on a number of times and we love talking to him. Dave Schultz is a professor in the political science department at Hamline University, where he teaches classes in American politics, public policy, and administration. He also holds an appointment at the University of Minnesota Law School and teaches, my favorite, election law and state constitutional law. So Dave, you wrote a piece at your blog post called Schultz's Take, and it was entitled COVID-19 and the Presidential Election. What if the states picked the Electoral College? That's a throwback to the past. So let's talk about how we're going to be approaching 2020 and what are the options other than what has historically been what we thought we were, where you go in and you vote and then the Electoral College takes over and then you're really pissed off because, you know, your vote didn't really matter.
That's right.
Because the Electoral College sort of trumps it. So everything has changed, in part because of COVID-19, and also in part because of Donald Trump, who's done a lot with the GOP to suppress the vote. We saw that just taking place in Wisconsin.
Right, exactly.
So walk me through what are the choices and what are the upsides and the downsides and the potential for each one of these choices.
Okay, so let's start with a variety of different things. Let's start with perhaps the most desirable, which is always a nice place to start some way, is that the most desirable, in my opinion, would be miraculously, we get, for example, Congress bipartisanly and the president to say that we're going to do something maybe like federal elections are all going to be vote by mail or some type of extended voting period where people have not just like the day of election, but let's say 45 days or something. But clearly something by vote by mail. There's a Amy Klobuchar, Ron Wyden bill right there. Out there right now that's trying to do that. Now, that would be great because if we're talking about the issue of dealing with the COVID virus, giving people the option to vote by mail probably is the best way of protecting people at this point. Having said that, I think it's fairly unlikely it's going to pass because very few things in Congress seem to get passed bipartisanly. The President of the United States, despite the fact that he votes by mail, says he hates vote by mail. So I think it's pretty unlikely to happen. And even if miraculously Congress were to do this and the President agreed to it, I'm a little skeptical regarding what kind of infrastructure the states are going to have in place to be able to implement a law like that this year, because we have many states that have no experience whatsoever with vote by mail and how they're going to get cranked up to do something like that. So that would be the most desirable, but I also think not likely.
Okay, so before we get into the next options, what I'm thinking about is I'm looking at Wisconsin. So while Wisconsin had a fairly vibrant absentee ballot situation, although they still ended up having the election on Election Day, I mean, the number of absentee ballots was five times the number of, you know, a couple of years before. So did they have the infrastructure? How long did it take for them to calculate? And that wasn't even technically vote by mail. That was just absentee ballots. And of course, it went back and forth to different courts before they figured out that as long as it was postmarked on the day of the election, it would count. I was talking to a friend about giving choices, you know, an absentee ballot or vote by mail or an extended 45 days. So you had three faces of Eve. You could either, you know.
Right.
And she said, so here's my problem. If we have a vibrant absentee ballot where there's no excuse, doesn't matter, anybody could do it, which is kind of the equivalent of a vote by mail, but we still had an election day, for example. She said, that's horrific. She said, do you know how many people I have to bring in for election day? She said, and most of my people are volunteers, and most of them are old.
That's right.
And they all are vulnerable to every illness known to man. She said, so I've got the worst case scenario. I've got thousands of absentee ballots or whatever the mail-ins are, and I have to staff with a vulnerable population that probably doesn't even want to show up, a bunch of old people, because you're still going to have an election.
That's right.
She said, you know, just, you know, fish or cut bait. Pick one or pick the other, but don't screw me with both because I don't know how to handle it let alone have the infrastructure in place.
And exactly the point I'm making here is that the difficulty of doing something like this, on the face of it, it sounds tantalizingly easy to say, let's say just do vote by mail. But once we have to start to think through the implementation, and let's say even if we went with your scenario and said just all early voting, vote by mail, we don't actually have an election day, we're still going to need what? Thousands of people to count all these ballots. And so it's not to say we shouldn't do it, but the human factor is still there. We still have to have lots of people to staff our counting, our election places. Now, my students, I didn't even throw it into this, by the way. My students always want to say, well, this is simple. Let's just do electronic voting. Let's just do this from our cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. And I turn to them and I say, how confident are you that the Russians or some hacker aren't going to hack into this? And they look at me and say, oh, yeah, you're right. That doesn't really seem to be an option either, because I think most of us are worried about the security and also the fact that if you do straight electronic voting, if it gets really close, we don't have a real ballot to count at the end of the day.
That paper backup.
Yes,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly.
At some point, paper's real. And we can always go, what, one? Two, you know, so we got something out there. Those I kind of sort of dismissed in terms of saying that either for technical reasons or partisan reasons are not going to happen.
As I'm also thinking about this, I want to just throw one other little sort of wrench into this conversation.
Right.
And that is that Donald Trump wants the Postal Service to basically disappear by June. On top of everything else, he is, instead of helping the United States Postal Service survive during COVID-19, the way he's helping the airline industry, and he's going to help the yacht industry, and he's going to help everyone else, he wants them to implode, which they technically could.
They really could.
And then we're really all screwed, because there will be either no mail service or very limited mail service. And what we know about mail service, which is so beautiful, is that it's everywhere. It's in every rural place in America. If you suddenly have it disappear, I think what people don't quite understand is not only will you miss the mail, but it turns out, I mean, from an Amazon perspective, Amazon uses the mail service for that last like mile into these rural places. So you still get your widget or whatever it is.
That's right.
So it's not just about the fact that Donald Trump is going, aha, I got rid of something I want to get rid of, but it will hurt your ability to vote. But it might also hurt the economy as well. So it's just so interesting.
Yeah, you're right. And also throw one other thing. If we do vote by mail, one of the big debates is right now, many states that have vote by mail make you buy your own postage. And was it 52 cents now for 50 cents? I'm forgetting what it is now for first class. To you and me, that may not sound like a lot. But for somebody who's sort of scraping by during any time period, let alone COVID virus, now to say, gosh, I got to fork over 50 cents to put a stamp on top of something, this sort of adds other problems to the mixture here. So
absolutely. And again, you were talking before about using it, like doing some kind of a technology thing, which we know right away probably won't work. But
that's right.
There's also the technology divide.
Of course there is. So,
I mean,
of course,
and we're seeing that now with schools being shut down.
Yes.
Where like entire communities of kids have no place to go because they're not connected to the internet. They don't have a computer. And so they're missing out. So again, it's the have technologies and the have not technologies. And from a voting perspective, what happens if you don't have technology? Then everyone lines up at the library to use the library's technology, but then you've got the whole problem again of COVID-19.
Exactly. So the mail doesn't work. Okay.
Oh, God.
So the mail may not work, but it may be the only solution I have. Okay. Then I said, okay, what about the fear that the president can cancel the election or postpone it? And I said, well, this is something to think about here. Now, we could argue and say he can't cancel the election or postpone it because what? This is done by federal law. Congress sets the date. President can't just unilaterally cancel it. Now, could the president declare a national emergency under the National Emergencies Act and say, I've got to suspend the election? He shouldn't be able to do so, but we got five justices on the Supreme Court who I'm not sure what they're going to do. But conversely, this becomes interesting now, is that the Constitution explicitly says that the president's term expires on January 20th at noon. So if there is no election, according to the plain language, about as plain as it reads to me, he's out of a job on January 20th. We could make this even more delightful. If he's out of a job on January 20th, that also means Mike Pence is out of a job.
Go on, go on.
Who do you think becomes president of the United States?
We get a first girl. We get the first girl. We get the first girl. Are you telling me that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House in her 80s, could in fact be the first female president of the United States?
No. Assuming the assuming the Democrats hold, which I think they should, assuming that Nancy Pelosi is still the Speaker, is that, yes, under this scenario here, if the president basically says no election, nothing happens, et cetera, January 20th kicks in, him and Michael are taking a walk, and it is now the youngster, Nancy Pelosi, who becomes the president of the United States under federal law for rules for presidential succession. So
I have a question for you. We've postponed the election, but that means we've also postponed the election for Congress, for Senate.
That's right.
For a lot of things. So what you're telling me is, but only for the purposes of the law and the Constitution, only the president and the vice president are basically removed in January. The members of the House and the Senate, they don't say anything about them. So therefore, whatever the status quo was at the time of what should have been the election will in fact still hold true. So that's Nancy will still be the Speaker of the House in January.
Right.
But we'll say au revoir to Pence and au revoir to Trump.
That's right. That's right. Perfect. So if you're a Democrat and you want to get rid of Trump and you want to make, as you said, to have the first girl be president, let the president go at this one, because you've now put in Nancy Pelosi as president. And just so you know, at that point, she gets to then what, under federal law, select her vice president subject to Senate confirmation. So who knows? You could get a doubleheader. You could get, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi and Elizabeth Warren if you wanted
it.
Wow.
Yeah. But it has to be approved by the Senate, and that's Mitch McConnell's Senate. I'm going to say this, don't shoot me, but I think she might even suggest maybe like a Mitt Romney, for example, as her VP.
Yeah.
She needs to have it approved. God. Let's make the movie, Dave. Let's make the movie. This is getting exciting.
Okay. But the other scenario I throw out now is to say that, remember, we all learned this, that the popular vote doesn't pick the president. It's the Electoral College. Right. And one of the things that we learned back in Bush v. Gore in 2000, we don't have a right to vote for president of the United States. The only people who vote for the president are the 538 members of the Electoral College every 4 years. We have no right. The Constitution gives to the states the right to pick the electors. It is merely by the grace of state legislatures from the early 19th century that people get to vote for to select the electors. So I said, okay, fail-safe scenario is what? The state legislatures take back and say, we're going to select the electors. And then I worked that scenario out and said that if the states do that, we've got 36 states where we got what's called a trifecta. The trifecta is where the governor and the legislature chambers are the same parties. Work that out. It gives Donald Trump a slight lead in the Electoral College. Then I said, okay, add a few more states in that have the easy overriding of governor vetoes. Trump still has the advantage. And then for the sake of argument, in the 14 states that are split, I said, okay, let's assign out and say that each of the states basically takes two of their electoral votes. One goes Democrat, one goes Republican, which is equivalent for the Senate, because each state gets a number of electors equal to number of senators plus House members. So they split that. And then let's award all the congressional districts to electoral votes to whoever won them last time for the sake of argument, how the states would do it, Trump wins.
So let me ask a question though. Is that making the assumption that majority takes all? So if it's a majority Republican in the House and Senate, that's the assumption that you would be making. Okay, and now is that valid? Because I know, for example, in Maine, that's not how they do it. In Maine, it's based on the congressional district, for example.
Yeah, Maine and Nebraska are the only two states in the country that do it by congressional. What I assume is in those 36 states where either Republicans control all the chambers or the Democrats control chambers, what I mean by that, governorship, House and Senate, or House and Assembly, whatever they call it like that, they're going to act partisanly. So for example, in the state of New York, you know, which is what, Democratic governor, you know, Assembly and Senate, they're going to award all their electoral votes to the Democratic candidate. Texas, which has got a trifecta for the Republicans, they're going to go that way. So that's how I made my assumption there.
Wow. You know, all these things come back to elections matter. Oh my God, we're looking at the state legislature and everyone always focuses on president or they focus on governor. And suddenly what this story tells is that your state legislature matters. I mean, in my little state of New Hampshire, the Democrats control everything but the governorship. That's right. I mean, everything, every congressional seat. And yet because they've lost that one seat, it really has been, he vetoed 55 bills. I mean, so it didn't matter that they owned everything. Yeah. It turned out they didn't have a veto-proof majority. And so he was able to be successful. But then you're beginning to realize that that state rep, that that state senator suddenly could have huge consequences if this is what it turns out to be.
So, right. And let me throw one more thing, why people forget about, you're right, because people forget that legislatures matter.
Yeah.
Think about why the legislatures matter intensely this year also, because you know what's going to happen next year? Redistricting.
Right.
And what do the state legislatures do? They draw the congressional lines and right. they draw their lines. And what they do will have an impact for a decade. 10 years ago, in 2010, the Democrats were sloppy. Midterm elections, the Republicans won a blowout, and they took control of state legislatures across the country. And so when 2011 happened, you know, the year after the census was done, they gerrymandered the heck out of a lot of states, and Democrats are still facing that problem now. So if you think that state legislative races don't matter, they matter intensely. For a lot of reasons.
We're talking with Dave Schultz. He has a blog that's entitled Schultz's Take, the blog of Hamline University Professor Dave Schultz. He teaches a lecture of law at the University of Minnesota. He teaches at Hamline University, teaches political science. So I want to sort of touch on like one more topic, even though sure. it's technically not what you were talking about. You mentioned the census. So one of the things we're now hearing is that they may extend the time frame for the census, that the ability to collect information on the census is being incredibly challenged by what's happened because of the pandemic. And therefore, you know, the ability to gain information is going to be a real challenge for people, because who's going to knock on anyone's door? Okay.
Right.
I mean? So what does that mean if they delay the census, Dave? I mean, does that mean that we then look at maybe the redistricting and all that stuff being delayed into the next term? So instead of it happening within that 2-year period, that it happens 2 years later? I mean, we don't know the challenges that are going to be made. I mean, the census is so important. You want every freaking person counted.
That's right.
But right now, there are people now that are hiding in shadows that have never hidden shadows before. And because of, you know, the COVID-19 and whether you could actually contract the illness, people don't necessarily respond to things because they're afraid to respond.
Yeah, and that's perfectly rational at this point, is that, I don't know about you, I'm not exactly, you know, I actually haven't had anybody do this recently, but if someone knocks on my door, I'm going to give them an awfully dirty look before I decide whether I'm going to open that door.
Exactly.
And that's completely rational. But also remember, I'm white and male. Now, if I happen to be Hispanic, or I speak a second language, you know, or my English is my second language, I don't know who's knocking on my door. Is it my local Amazon dealer, or is it the local what, ICE or something like that,
right,
suddenly thinking about deporting me? And also thinking about the fact that even though we're not asking the citizenship question, we managed to keep that off, I may be very scared to answer any questions whatsoever, you know, in the climate that we have. So the census is going to be a challenge this time, more so than any other time in American history. It all depends on how much of a delay.
That's my question. Go on.
If we're talking about just a few months, probably no big deal, you know, but let's sketch out our Chamber of Horrors argument here, that we can't get it done for a while, and then we get a second wave coronavirus coming in the fall that again delays it till next year. This just creates a lot of problems at this point, because we're supposed to be having our 2022 elections based upon the census. So we've got some slack, you know, that there might be a few elections in 2021 that were dependent upon or contingent upon redrawing. But it's really, we've got some slack till we get to 2022. But knowing how much the census is fought over, or not the census, how much the redistricting is fought over, you know, this redistricting is going to be litigated to death in the courts.
Well, and again, that's where the delay on the census is also
yes.
going to be part of the litigation.
That's
because
right.
frankly, what a lot of the Republicans, especially since they were so successful after the last census, they would love to say mañana, 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 especially if it looks like the Democrats have taken control of some state legislatures where it had been historically Republican.
Right.
So they would rather sort of run in place with what they currently have than look at the potential for what the new census is going to indicate. I mean, let's be honest. Texas is growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, so they're going to see a huge new number of folks that are now going to be given new seats because there are going to be more members of Congress coming from Texas. Texas is also a very interesting place because it is on the potential of going from red to purple, if not blue. So that's it could actually be segueing into something else. You know, the Republicans who now control everything in Texas, they're going to want to make every excuse and litigate when they actually have to redistrict because they like the current state of affairs. They're maybe willing to give up a couple of seats just to maintain the status quo.
Right. And I think one of the other things that's scaring Republicans this year, I'm going to go back to Wisconsin. Okay. Republicans did about everything they absolutely could to jerry-rig that election and suppress the vote. And guess what happened? A Democrat-leaning or liberal-leaning justice of the Supreme Court still won because Democrats, as sick as they might have been, as suppressed as it was in Milwaukee County, they only had five polling places open?
Out of 180. They had 108. But that goes, again, to the problem with having an election is that they had to close all those polling sites because nobody wanted to work.
Right. But this is the point I'm getting at here is that what's scaring Republicans is given all the suppression they did there, a Democrat won or a liberal won. Democrats came out to vote. And that is a scary sight for them this coming year is and going into the future is what? The Democrats seem to be motivated in ways they weren't 4 years ago. And that scares them.
All right. So I just want to sort of talk a little bit about what happened. Because in Wisconsin, what was interesting was that it went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and they decided you can't delay the election. Right. It went to the United States Supreme Court and they too decided that you can't delay the absentee ballots. You know, that it had to be, I guess they did give you a little bit extra by saying it could be postmarked on the day of the election. So that was something that was new and gave people a couple more hours or whatever. As we're looking at possibly postponing an election in November, it would probably be litigated and go to the United States Supreme Court. The new pivotal justice, shock of shocks, is Justice Roberts.
Yep.
He disappointed me in Wisconsin. What do you think he would do when we're talking about 50 states, a presidential election, a pandemic, also having seen what happened in Wisconsin? Do you think he might have a change of heart or legal head?
I'll speak as a law professor and a political scientist at the same time.
Okay,
and the reason why I say that is that it's possible he could view things differently. But there's something else also clear about Roberts. This is the political science in me speaking. He hates the president.
Yeah.
He hates him. Yeah. In the impeachment, he's not a voter. You know, in the Senate trial, he's not a voter. You know, so his role there was basically duck and cover.
Would he, when
push comes to shove, after the president has picked on him, yelled at him, accused him of a whole bunch of different things, the final justice?
But the other reason I think, and it may not even just be as emotional as get even, but he is someone who believes in the institutions of government.
He does.
He is someone who actually, he wants the courts to be respected.
Yeah.
He wants Congress to be a place that should be respected. Frankly, he wants the president to be a place where there's respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Barack Obama sort of on occasion was, you know, a little bit obnoxious to the Supreme Court. But Donald Trump has basically undermined every aspect of what is makes up our democracy. There is no institution that he hasn't tried to destroy.
Yep.
And I think that in a lot of ways, it isn't as much personal for Roberts as that he sees this as a human being who's basically tried to undermine everything. And as a result, because he so values these institutions, that he might be that swing vote in a different way.
I would hope so. That's what I'm saying. If the law professor in me wants to say, I hope he does. But if he doesn't, the political scientist in me comes out and says, maybe at the end of the day, when political scientists tell us what, that personal biases, so forth, sometimes factor into decisions. So in either case, let's hope he does the right thing for the right reason or does the right thing for maybe the wrong reason.
Well, the reason why we reached out to David Schultz is that this is such a fun conversation. He teaches at Hamline University. His blog post was entitled COVID-19 and the Presidential Election. What if the states pick the Electoral College delegates? Thank you so much for doing this, Dave. It's fun to imagine at the same time, it's terrifying.
It is. So, it is. All right. Thanks a lot.
You. Ciao.
Right, bye, Artie. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much. Change.